Hello and welcome to iVow. I'm Jenny Prisk, your host for this podcast conversation. And we're delighted to welcome back to our conversation Kailan Hunter, or I should say Major Kailan Hunter, because we first interviewed Kailan when she was a peace researcher at the Joan B. Kroc Institute for Peace and Justice with the 2017 Women Peacemakers. We're now delighted to welcome her as Major Hunter, because prior to graduate school, Kai, as she has invited me to call her, spent over a decade as an officer in the United States Marine Corps flying the Super Cobra attack helicopters. Welcome to our conversation, Kai.
Hi, thank you so much for having me again.
It's good to see you. So you spent over a decade in the Marine Corps. How and why did you get into that profession?
That's a question I get a lot. I'm sure my parents still wonder how and why I did, because it definitely was not part of my upbringing, which is usually the first question you get. You know, who in your family was in the Marine Corps?
Well, I was going
nobody.
To ask that, but
yes.
I won't
nobody.
Now.
Yes. I was the first. I had finished up my undergraduate at Georgetown University and was working for a little telecom startup area, and as many people did back in the day. And I was just sort of bored, you know, office work. It was a great company. I love the people I work with, but I did not find it exciting at all. And I was out for a run one day around the mall in Washington, D.C., and they had all of the recruiting stuff that was up. You know, I don't know exactly what event was going on, but there was, you know, all the military recruiting. And I was like, oh, well, that would be exciting. And so that could be an adventure. That's not going to be boring if I do that.
Right.
And my first thought was actually that I would join the National Guard as a way of sort of easing in to this, rather than like jumping in with both feet and being like, well, you know, maybe I could just do like a weekend a month adventuring sort of thing. And well, they never called me back, but the Marine Corps did. And I think it was not to toot my own horn, but Georgetown grad who spoke a few languages and was a Division I athlete, they were like, you're not leaving ever. Like, you're going to stay, and until we can send you to OCS, we're going to like lock you in our little office.
And just for our listeners, OCS?
Oh, Officer Candidate School.
Thank you.
So going in as a college graduate, I went through the officer pipeline rather than going through Paris Island, where the enlisted goes. So it was in Quantico, Virginia. Mm-hmm. And I actually didn't tell my parents until right before I was getting ready to leave. It was a bit of a shock. It came quickly.
Are you all still speaking?
Oh, yes, yes. And they came out, you know, they came out to my OCS graduation, and it was great. And actually, one of the best stories, I think, from my OCS graduation was we were getting ready. We had a little lunch thing the day before, and all of the OCS people and a lot of generals and sergeants major from around the D.C. area always come down. And my father was talking to one of the older generals, I think 2-star or 3-star at the time. He was asking my dad about Vietnam and was like, well, what were you doing during, because they were very clearly the same age. You know, what were you doing during Vietnam? My dad's like, well, I was sitting on the railroad tracks protesting. And, you know, the general was like, oh, well, I was, you know, leading troops in Vietnam. But, you know, he looked at my father and he said, you know, that's what's so great about this country, that we can sit together today and have lunch, you know, and become friends. And they have developed a friendship. And
That continues,
yeah. Right. And that's something, I mean, this a whole other thing to talk about is like, you know, the political climate and how that isn't the case anymore, unfortunately. But it really gave me hope kind of early on in my career that this was something that was a calling to actually serve and not to judge people. And I think more importantly to, even though I joined for adventure's sake and wanting to do something that was more fun than sitting in an office, you know, there was a purpose to be able to kind of build some of those bridges between people who you wouldn't necessarily think of as being the same.
Yeah, that's very interesting. You've raised a number of questions for me, but I want to go back to your tenure as the Super Cobra helicopter pilot. You were the first woman chosen on the East Coast to fly.
Yeah, with my squadron, I was there, yeah.
And how did that come about you were selected? Because I'm sure there were other potential candidates.
Well, the number of women in Marine Corps aviation is very, very, very small.
Mm-hmm.
It's tiny. I don't know. I think when I was going through, it was like less than 2% of the women who were like less than 1% of the officer corps. And I don't have those exact numbers, but tiny, like very, very, very small numbers. So they're just, they're not a lot of female aviators at all.
Okay.
And the process is, a lot of it was really needs of the Marine Corps. I actually went into flight school not really knowing what I wanted to fly. Again, when I went into officer candidate school, they told me, they're like, well, you can go to flight school and fly anything you want, or you can go be like an administrative officer. I was like, well, I'm trying to get away from administration, so I'll go fly things. And I knew, I was so ignorant about everything coming in. Like, I had no idea. I mean, I had seen like Apocalypse Now, and like that was my, that was sort of my version of like military pilots, I think, was from that. And I actually didn't even want to fly helicopters at first, and because I thought they were terrifying. I was, these things are not supposed to.
You can see through the bottom of them.
Well, and they don't, you know, if the engines go out in an airplane, like, it wants to stay in the air. You know, they look like they want to fly. Helicopters, you know, the joke is that they fly because they're so ugly the earth repels them.
And oh, that's interesting.
That's, you know, so I was very skeptical about all of this, but it's, as many things in the military, it's not really up to you. You'd salute smartly and say, yes, sir, that's what I will fly, if that's what the Marine Corps needs me to fly.
Yes.
And so I...
you learned to fly.
I learned to fly, yes. Right. And so I ended up, after my primary flight school, getting selected for helicopters. And so I said, okay. It was a bit of a struggle. I am not a natural pilot. I had to learn. Like, there are some people who it would frustrate the hell out of me. It was like they just walked in and were natural, like, oh, dee-dee-dee-dee, here I go flying. That was not the case for me.
I had to really
work hard to learn. Once I did, I loved it. And then again with the Cobras, it was needs of the Marine Corps selection. They needed Cobra pilots. I had the appropriate scores to do it. And so off I went.
And I understand you did two tours in Iraq. Do you want to talk about those?
Deployments are one of those interesting things where it's actually a lot of tedium and boredom punctuated by a few exciting events.
So you did get your exciting events, no doubt.
I did get the adventures that I joined for, but the one thing they don't tell you is that it's a lot of repetitive work that you do day in, day again. It would be, make 99% of military life would make really bad recruiting commercials. But but it's completely worth it. Completely worth it. But it was kind of the running joke in my head that I would have. It's like, I joined for adventures and I'm, you know, writing a weight and balance report instead. You know, but
sweeping
a floor. Right.
Yes.
But it's all for a great purpose. I think in some of the, a lot of those things that we would have to kind of laugh at to break up some of the, you know, the tedium of deployments. And it's, you know, as people who have gone will say, you know, war is the most boring and most exciting thing you'll have ever done, because there is a lot of, you're kind of waiting around for the action, more or less. But you need to stay sharp and you need to stay focused and you need to have, you know, good training. So in those moments when it does matter,
yes,
and you're there to do the right thing.
And I'm sure you had many moments that mattered considerably. I'd like to find out from you what it was like being a female in, possibly you'll be able to tell us the balance, but were you with all males? Were you treated?
So I was with pretty much all males. Another female pilot came in shortly after I'd got there. It was within the first year, but later on in that year. So she came there. So it was a 99% male.
Yes, yes. So even, how was that?
And she was a Huey pilot, not a Cobra pilot. So we were on same squadron, but other jobs. So it was, you know, it was interesting. It was one of those things that I felt like in deployment times, it almost didn't matter, because the gender differences go away quite a bit when you have a job and everybody has a purpose, and it just comes down to being able to fly, or if you're a maintainer, being able to maintain. You know, that's what matters. It was, you know, it was back at home, stateside, that the gender differences were much more apparent.
Can you give us an example of that?
I think, you know, again, we when we think about gender bias, we can think about kind of the overt, explicit things that happen, but then the more covert, just sort of ingrained cultural things that when units or job areas, whatever, groups have been all male, they don't really realize what they're doing and how kind of toxic the culture that they're perpetuating is. Mm-hmm. So on the, you know, on the more open side, there were a few just blatant, you know, having people told me, like, I will, things are going to be harder for you because I don't want anyone to think I'm taking it easy on a woman. Which I was like, well, how about you just treat me the same?
Yes. And what sort of response did you get to that?
There's interesting rank structures involved too. Like, okay. I was a very junior pilot at the time, so mm-hmm. it was hard for me to really push back. But I think I definitely proved myself that mm-hmm. I could do it. It was a bit frustrating to say, like, well, I had to do it, you know, better than everybody else. And then there's also more overt things like assumptions that, you know, the after parties to events are going to be at the strip club, and that's just where everyone goes. And so it's like, well, you have to play along if you want to be a part of the group. And
so there's a culture inside the military that you obviously were experiencing.
There is. Mm-hmm. And it's a culture that's, you know, it's internal to the military, but it's also something that we as a U.S. population have really fed the military. I think going back to World War One, at least, there's great documentation of it. You know, we reward military men with scantily clad or naked women. And whether it is the pinup girls who were sent or the, you know, sending cheerleaders who walk around in crop tops and miniskirts in a war zone. I mean, you're sending these, like, this isn't, you know, if we are really telling our servicemen that they're supposed to treat women exactly, you know, the same as colleagues, as equals, and yet as a society, and these are sanctioned events, this is what we're saying is morale boosting. You know, we're sending really mixed signals, and you wonder why. And I think that's when we talk about some of the cultural issues. You know, there's always off-color comments that are made. There's the ammunition manufacturers still send pinup calendars that are, say, much more explicit than any of the 1940s pinup girls that are there. You know, that somehow that's, it is, you know, what men need to fight wars is scantily clad women, which is, you know, to be blunt, bullshit, if we want to call it what it is. And now you can put a little E by your podcast for me there. But it is. But it harms the, you know, it harms unit, when we talk about unit cohesion and unit integrity, these are the things that are ruining it. Because you have women who are not just competent at their jobs, but essential for the mission. You know, had I not been there as a, you know, had you taken me away, you would have been at a loss of a pilot with an essential skill set that was needed to perform the mission. You know, if you pull out a, whether she's a infantry marine or a communications marine or, you know, a logistics marine, if you pull her out of the unit, your unit's not going to function appropriately. So we need to really work on what sort of messages we send to the culture, to the military, as what's acceptable behavior, what it means to be a warrior, what it means to have honor, courage, and commitment, which are the things that, as a Marine Corps, we claim are our core principles. But, you know, if we don't have the courage to actually honor and have a commitment to those that we work alongside every day, nothing's going to change.
And for our girls and young women who are considering a career in the military, you would probably hope that a lot of this could change by the time they got there.
Exactly, because I think that the in a lot of my dissertation work, to loop in some of my academic side of this as well, you know, I look at variations of military effectiveness, especially with regards to how women, the way in which women are integrated into the military. And you know, there's two very largely successful models of integrating women in such a way that, you know, it's not just integrating women in for the sake of having women, but they've had measurable positive impact on mission effectiveness. So to really bring it back to the, you know, the military has a job. It's not just a group of guys doing something, but there's a purpose for it. But we can empirically measure that, especially in the type of wars we're currently fighting, when we're fighting counterinsurgencies in Afghanistan still, when we're doing a lot of training and advising of groups in Syria. These are areas that, and Iraq again, but these are areas that has been proven that having women as part of the main effort, as part of the primary unit, so that would be the infantry unit in any of these, you know, military services, matters. But it's not just having them. So there's, you know, in counterinsurgencies, you need to work with the population. You know, we're not fighting wars like we fought in World War II, where you had, you know, the Nazis on one side and the Allied troops on the other, and you march towards each other and had a big clash outside of the city. Like, that's not happening. We are...
War is different.
War is different. And we're fighting in villages, and it's as much, and I would probably say more so, about the restraint of force as the use of force. And you need the ability to take swift, kinetic, and decisive action when you have to. You know, if you've got to go in and kill the bad guys to protect yourself, to like make it very simple, you need that training, you need that unit cohesion. Mm-hmm. But along with it, you need the ability to live and work and gain the trust of the local population, because that's where the enemy's living. You know, the Taliban in Afghanistan is living in the villages. They're not mm-hmm. a separate fighting force that's sending an army out to meet ours. They're living there. They're living in houses. They're building roads. They're doing all the things that we claim to be doing as well. And so to defeat that, if that truly is our purpose, and to not just defeat them, but to create the conditions to allow for a lasting peace and a lasting stability, we need the engagement of the entire Afghan population. Mm-hmm. To do that, we need women. Mm-hmm. You know, that it is impossible to engage communities without women. So we need women who are well-trained in infantry tactics, well-integrated into the infantry units, because those times when kinetic action is needed, they need to be a part of it. The whole purpose is, you know, there was always these arguments around banning women in the U.S. because there'll be a liability on the battlefield. Well, they're a liability because you don't train them. You know, that there's nothing inherent in, mm-hmm. in like
it's
your DNA that makes you a liability. You're a liability if you're untrained. If you throw an untrained man out there, he's a liability too.
Of course.
You know, look at Vietnam, look at Korea with mm-hmm. the way that we were sending ill-trained recruits. They were huge liabilities. Mm-hmm. Gender is not the issue. It's the training. And mm-hmm. so we need to integrate and train women. And there's been two really successful models that we've seen of this happening, and the U.S. is not one of them. You know, there's the... You know, the Scandinavian model, where everything is very, very gender neutral, where men and women are treated exactly the same, and it's all differences are kind of tamped out, squashed down, that we don't want to see any different. And then there's the more French model, where women are treated as women, and they do that. It is very explicit that they are doing women things, but they are. The women things, you know, that they do are as valued and as much of an essential part of the mission. Mm. Mm. And so it keeps it is still very gendered, yet there's actual equality in the genderedness, that it's not, we need women because it's different and they're going to do the separate thing. No, they work side by side. They work completely ingrained. They have the same physical standards, same technical training standards, but you know, they have different grooming standards, your uniform standards, for example, because mm. part of their benefit is the fact that they're also a woman. Mm-hmm. This actually kind of harkens back to the French Resistance days when the French women would kill the Nazis. So it's, you know, that they've had different experiences, but I think we as a country need to figure out, rather than pretending that women just don't exist, which is kind of what the military's been good at for a long time, mm-hmm. and it's resulted in all of the recent scandals that have been in the news, huge instances of rape and military sexual assault, mm-hmm. A big part of the result of why, you know, female veterans are the group that's going to kill, like the group that's most likely to commit suicide in the country. You know, a female veteran is 250% more likely than a female civilian to kill herself. A lot of that is, I think, is that we've just pretended that this isn't that they're not there. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Rather than saying, how are we going to integrate them in a way that is efficient and effective and that serves our military well and that actually promotes military effectiveness?
Has this knowledge that you've gained about these differences led to your dissertation for your doctorate, mm-hmm. which
yes.
I know you'll be completing in
yes.
2018? If I may, the title is Shoulder to Shoulder, Yet Worlds Apart, Understanding Variation in Women's Integration in the Military in the United States, France, and Norway. Mm-hmm. And so you've just referred to those differences. Yep. If you could give advice to the top brass in the military in the United States, what would it be with regard to gender?
So the first thing I would say is that we have to acknowledge that it exists, that it is there, and that women mm-hmm. women are in the military and women have different experiences than men. And mm-hmm. we need to just say that, we before saying if it's right or wrong, and that there should be a, you know, we should try to gender neutralize things, or if we want to gender equalize things, whatever path we take, the first thing that has to happen in the top brass is to say, no, women are here and women have different experiences than men. And mm-hmm. that goes back to our socialization process from the day we're born, that this is the way society is.
Yes, being given a doll or being given a truck.
The truck, right. And it came, I was at a Marine Corps breakfast this summer, and the Commandant of the Marine Corps, he's like, it took me 40 years, basically, of my career to actually point blank ask a woman what her feelings were about being here. So that's the first thing that has to happen, is we need to have these conversations, and we need mm-hmm. to actually listen to and believe women that, like, these are the things that are happening, because we need them in our military. And then the next thing I would say we have to do is actually make some of the structural provisions that allow for women to serve on equal footing as men. Mm-hmm. One thing in my dissertation work, and then as well as focus groups I've done with the Defense Advisory Committee on Women in the Services, you see is that whether we like it or not, as a society, parenting falls primarily on mothers. The debate as to whether or not that's right or wrong is outside mm-hmm. the scope of this, but it's right. It happens.
It's been proven.
Right, right. And things like I was at a Navy base talking to women, and one of the reasons that was cited more and more that women are getting out of the military, these are enlisted women who work on the decks of the aircraft carriers, the decks of the ships, is that they have to get qualifications at night. Like, there's something like you have to qualify during the day and qualify at the night for your job, because if you're going to be underway on a boat, you're mm-hmm. there 24 hours a day, and if something happens, you have to be able to do it at night when it's dark and there's different lighting schemes, and knowing what that all means and being able to operate effectively mm-hmm. in the dark
with our eyesight yes.
right, is important. However, for the entire region of San Diego, which is where we did our focus groups, which is huge naval presence,
yes,
there's only one child care center that will watch kids at night, that's a military base, and it has a 3 to 5 year waiting list.
Oh my goodness.
And so women are leaving primarily because they're like, I can't be competitive.
There's no support.
Right. And so their options are really to somehow move a family member out here.
Yes.
To yes. live with them, to watch the kids. Yeah. If they're dual military families, they run into issues of their spouse will often have to do things in the evening or night, or if it's during the daytime, their spouse needs to be sleeping at night because you have crew rest issues of being mm-hmm. competent for your job the next day and you can't necessarily rely on it. But a bigger is that nearly 30% of the women in the military are single mothers across mm. And so that puts a lot, especially these young enlisted women, who are, they're not making a lot of money. They can't afford an overnight. I mean, getting overnight childcare is incredibly, incredibly expensive.
Mm-hmm. And challenging to find that person who'll do it.
Right, to have somebody who will do it all. But so if you look at, in France, for example, in 1985, they passed a law that if you're a government employee, you have to have access to childcare at a discounted or free rate, depending on how much money you actually make. They have a scheme for it there, at any time that you have a job requirement. So the government being a, mm-hmm. or the military being a government employer, women were guaranteed that they would have access to overnight childcare if their job demanded that they work at night, which mm-hmm. just about every military job has some time when they demand you to work at night. Mm-hmm. What that actually ended up doing was leveling the playing field, so women were able to get the same qualifications as men. So then it became based off of merit. Promotions became based off of merit rather mm-hmm. than, because they were able to do the same things. And so women ended up becoming promoted, women stayed in longer, and then they can actually impact the military in a better way. Here, you see women getting out earlier, at every stage, women get out earlier than men. And one of the number one reasons that's cited is that it's prohibitive to get childcare. Like it's mm-hmm. it's too expensive.
Mm. So there's a lot of changes yet to be made.
A lot of these structural changes need to be made, I think, that allow women to actually serve on an equal footing mm-hmm. as men.
Major Kylan Hunter, this is such a fascinating conversation. I could spend hours learning from you. I do remember, though, in an earlier conversation, just to go back to perhaps a positive connotation,
yes.
you mentioned a niece of
yes.
yours and something she said.
Yeah, so I think that there are positive changes. We're at an all-time high for the number of women in. Mm-hmm. We're at the all-time high for women's leadership. I think, the popularity of books like Ashley's War, the Washington Post just did their big Veterans Day profile was all on women. So
excellent.
The the visibility and the status and the elevation is getting raised, and it is having a real impact, I think, on the next generation. I have a niece, and she was 5 or 6 at the time of saying this, and she, you know, they were talking about in her little class what they wanted to be when they grow up, and one of the boys mentioned wanting to be a pilot, and she was just like, nope, I think that's a girl's job. It's going to be really hard for you to do that. And so I think how much things have changed, I know, from when I was growing up, that where for me to become a pilot, people still look at me like, oh, you are? Or when I would be at air shows, how did you get this helicopter here? I'm like, well, I flew it. So, I mean, that's I know it's shocking.
Yes.
But so there's a...
But we want to get past that shocking.
Right.
Yes,
and
we want to get past
we
it.
We are. And there definitely is, you know, in seeing what the dreams for the younger generations are and how they're not seeing this as a gendered profession and just a profession that... If that's what they want to do, it's be a great thing to do.
Great.
Is really making me excited.
Oh, that's good to hear. And just to close, your dreams for your future, what will it contain?
Finishing up my PhD, and I would love to be in an academic position, professorship position. I think that in addition to the research work I do around women's integration and military effectiveness, I really think more and more, especially we have a huge generation of veterans coming back and going to school, that having a veteran-based leadership would be really important for our upcoming generations.
Well, it sounds pretty important to me. Well, Major Kylan Hunter, thank you so much for joining us today and sharing all your perspectives on women in the military.
Thank you.